Hey folks, it's John. Welcome back to another episode of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired that I literally record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach, or at least I did before we had COVID shutdowns. Now, everything is being recorded in my living room, on my couch, my walks through the neighborhood, because we're working from home. We're trying to figure out what life looks like as we go back for the new normal, and as teachers figured out a long time ago, the three best parts about teaching sometimes is June, July, and August. We get that 9-month work and then that 3-month break. But this year, maybe more than any other year, these 3 months are probably going to be spent kicking it in overdrive to figure out what we need to do when we come back. So, podcast is every Monday, hopefully to give you tips and resources you might be able to use in your classrooms, and ways to change the game, and whatever your role in education might be. I have a website, which is www.adrenalinerush.com. It has a bunch of templates and resources. You can borrow those. That's adrenaline with an E, like educational ed adrenaline. And I wrote a book called Adrenaline Rush. Feel free to check that one out. It's on Amazon. It's about game-changing student engagement inspired by theme parks, mud runs, and escape rooms. Let's talk about it and anything else you want. On Twitter, I'm on Twitter at MeehanEDU. But today's podcast will be slightly different than just about most of the other podcasts that I've written or put together. And I want to give a heads up, not as a trigger warning per se, but as a consent notice, because I think that if I talk about playful learning and game-based learning, consent predates and precludes everything. Game-based learning and games reserve the right to say, hey, I want to play, or I no longer want to play, or you're not playing fair. So as a consent notice, today's podcast, we'll be talking about things that may be challenging involving politics and race, and it might be uncomfortable. So if this doesn't sound like the thing that you're interested in, no harm, no foul. We can feel free to just opt out and come back next week. We'll talk about more. But I do think there's no such thing as a political classroom, and sometimes even though we try to avoid it, we have to be aware of how to join in these conversations as educators. So that's what today's podcast will be about in closer detail. Also, full disclosure, if you follow me on Twitter, I have been a part of a number of these protests in Washington, D.C. They have been largely peaceful from my understanding of them, but that is, again, my own personal bias. I know I'm speaking from my own bias. I also know that I am a white male who is middle class and heterosexual cisgendered. So for all of these reasons, I know there's only a lens that I can speak to my own lived experience, and I do not pretend to speak for those or anyone else who is not my lived experience. But to have to say that, I will also recognize that I speak on behalf of a Catholic educator who works in a Catholic school, and so some of the things that I might say today might push buttons on either side of the political aisle. The Catholic Church is a universal church, you know, capital C. It really does mean like this universal church, and I know that the church has its own sins of the past and skeletons in the closet, for which I make no apologies. But I do also recognize that that narrow two-party system that the United States often finds itself in doesn't neatly align with either one or the other teachings as it comes to the Catholic Church. And though there are pieces and parts that fall on both sides, I'm probably going to offend people on both sides of the aisle today, so I apologize in advance. Okay, enough disclaimer. Let's get to the meat and potatoes of a very hard conversation. Because we all agree that racism is bad. Yes? Hopefully yes. If the answer is no, we should probably part at this point because I'm probably going to offend you for reasons that are not involving politics. I see that racism, and this is my, again, my personal vote. You don't have to take it as gospel, but I see racism as a human rights issue, as a social justice issue. I do not see it as an issue that is political. Though the Black Lives Matter movement does have a lot of touch points that involve people who are on the political left, in my understanding of it, as a person who recognizes that all lives matter, and I think that anybody who's a decent human being should be able to say that sentence. Yes, all lives matter. For me, all lives can't matter until you recognize that each life matters. And if each life matters, that means white lives matter, and brown lives matter, and yellow lives matter, and black lives matter. Period, full stop. If you can't say that black lives matter, then you can't say that all lives matter, because they are a part of all lives. I hope that makes sense. So that conversation needs to be had in more classrooms. And thankfully, I do think the numbers that we're seeing seem to suggest it's not just people on one side of the political aisle who are turning out for these protests, both in the United States and abroad. I read some recent figures today that said as many as 25 million human beings are estimated to have participated in these marches over the past month, which seems to suggest that it's not just Democrats in the United States, but rather it's people hungry for change and hungry for a systemic recognition that something has been wrong, as they say in Shakespeare, something is rotten in the state of Denmark. and it needs to change, and it's needed to change for a long, long time. And I don't think they're protesting in Great Britain because they want to see justice in the United States. They're protesting in Great Britain because they want to see the same systemic reforms with their own police as well. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe everyone is just really excited to protest on behalf of the United States, but I don't believe in this case that it's relegated to a uniquely American issue. And so for that reason, my podcast, I know people listen to it all over the United States and all over the world. I think I'm speaking to you. I hope I'm speaking to you, that I'm speaking on behalf of somebody who's trying to be reasonable and trying to be inclusive. This is a really important part to start today's conversation, because inclusion and the big tent party, whether it's the Catholic Church or the worldwide reform, it's kind of where I'm going to go with today's podcast. And this might offend some people. And I'm, like I said, not trying to actively pick fights, but I am trying to stand up for what I believe in and use what limited platform I have as an educator who has a few thousand people who's read his book or visit his website or follow me on Twitter to say, hey, this is what I need to say so that we don't get ourselves too spun up on one side or the other of this political issue. There is no room for silence. I think that bears firm understanding. I think that's a Desmond Tutu quote. If you choose silence, you always side with the oppressor. So I do think we should be talking about it. But I'm going to send a few words today as a caution to educators who are operating from what I would consider to be, and again, this is just one person's opinion, but what I would consider to be a scarcity mindset. A scarcity mindset presumes that there's only a limited number of resources available to be shared by X number of humans, whereas a surplus mindset says, hey, there's more than we could ever think to teach. Do what you got to do. There's so much out there. Let's see how we can help. Individually, personally, privately, I think you should be doing work on a PD, on a school, on an admin team to commit to ways to dismantle systemic racism, both in your own thinking, in your own pedagogy, in your own classroom, and in the work and the way that you think to teach your curriculum. I absolutely think that needs to happen individually. But on a classroom level, and this is, again, a very touchy subject, so I really want to be very, very careful how I say it. In our classrooms, there's a lot of pushback and a lot of understandable hurt that are coming from people who are saying, in light of all of this, let's get rid of that. And getting rid of monuments that memorialize people who took up arms against the United States to defend institutions of horrible, horrible enslavement, I have no issues. Get rid of those, knock those suckers down. What I do have issues with, though, is this idea that we can't teach Book X because it doesn't go far enough in talking about this issue, or we can only teach Book Y because it's a better representation of this issue than another one. The problem with social justice and social reform is that ultimately, over time, everything will change. And certain books will age out of curriculum, and that's fine, and they should. While other books can age into curriculum, and that's great, as they should too. But this idea of what I'm seeing online called a cancel culture does become challenging, because I think there's this idea that once a text is labeled, quote, problematic, it immediately goes on the cut list, the ban list, the remove list. And I think there's a difference between books that are problematic and books that are provocative. In fact, I would argue that most texts in many curriculum, especially in ELA classrooms, should be provocative. They should make you think about race, think about gender, think about social justice, think about oppression, think about human rights. That's what good books do. That's what good works of fiction do. They kind of challenge our thinking. Just because a book has a character in it who is racist doesn't mean that that book is to be thrown out baby with the bathwater. I do think in a surplus mindset, you can say, hey, this book is only but one story, and there are a lot of other stories we need to contextualize as we talk about this. So I would encourage teachers who are looking to get rid of Book X and replace with Books Y or Z to instead consider, well, what if we could do a really powerful unit of a paired text where we took Book X alongside Book Y and Book Z, or excerpts from Books X and Y and Z. And to give a particularly noteworthy example that's been in the conversation of late on Twitter, I look at To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, which is like this watershed book of the 1960s about social justice through the fictional town of Macomb, Alabama. It is a fictional story where a young girl who is white learns from her father, who is also white, that mockingbirds never did anything to harm anybody. And these mockingbirds, all they do is sing for us, and here we are trying to hurt them. That's a bad idea. So in her book, the story of a young woman named Scout Finch, she's raised by her father, who's an attorney in town, Atticus Finch, and he takes on a losing cause to defend a black man falsely accused of a crime, even though he knows it's unwinnable in this very racist town in which they live. It presents this through what has become to be termed as a problematic or white savior narrative. And I guess I want to challenge this briefly, not to say that there is nothing true about that critique, because I do think there is some truth to that. Even though Atticus tries this case and fails in saving Tom Robinson, it's seen as the black man, the poor black man, needs the white man to do the work for him. And that did always sit sort of funny with me, even in the teaching of it, when I was working in a predominantly black and brown school. I felt that was uncomfortable. As a white educator, I'm basically saying, hey, kids of color, read this story. See how the white guys need to do a better job of helping you out? I didn't like that. It struck me as false, and it struck me as something that was very almost like just talking down to my kids. It felt like it was very patronizing. And I didn't like that, because it was basically saying that their fate was in my hands, and there was no empowerment, and there was no authenticity to the stories that were theirs. When I stacked it up against other stories in the classroom, I found a lot more genuine conversation about empowerment and excitement and engagement through texts like Eugenia Collier, who wrote an awesome short story called Sweet Potato Pie. And in it, students grapple with issues of race and code switching and cultural identity and cultural baggage and the history of racism and sharecropping. And immediately my black and brown students wanted to have that conversation keep going, where they just couldn't wait for To Kill a Mockingbird to be over. I'm not saying that To Kill a Mockingbird is a bad text. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that in my own experience teaching it, it didn't work as well as teaching Eugenia Collier. But I think that's because if I had it to do over again, what I did is I taught them each in isolation of one another. If I had it to do over again, I'm wondering, in this paired text mentality, could I have taken an excerpt of To Kill a Mockingbird and put it alongside that short story by Eugenia Collier? Could I have taken the trial sequence where Atticus Finch is fighting for the freedom of Tom Robinson and said, wow, this white guy's trying to do the best that he can, except, uh-oh, there's a problem here, guys, because it takes away this human element from this other person. It makes them just like a pawn in a game, a means to an end. And that feels like it's unreal. Can we look at this and compare it to the story of Charlie and Buddy in this Eugenia Collier piece? And how much stronger, then, is that unit as a direct result of bringing in own voices paired with these classic or traditional books of the canon? And in my own teaching, then, I was like, well, that's really a powerful way to talk about a lot of stuff, and stuff that's good, and stuff that's necessary, because I'm not trying to cancel any books. I think censorship is stupid. I think the political left are probably the people who are the most on fire for let's not ever censor or ban books. And yet, here we are, right back to the same conversations we had 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Let's get rid of Huckleberry Finn. Let's get rid of To Kill a Mockingbird. Let's get rid of Uncle Tom's Cabin. These books are flashpoints or like time capsules into how social justice and social advocacy worked at that time. Even though maybe they are made palatable to white audiences because there is a lens of whiteness into which the story begins its conversations about race, I think there's a lot of power in taking those things and saying, well, let's examine that as a text that is fundamentally of its time, but also provocative yet flawed. Could we then take that and put it alongside a text like Their Eyes Are Watching God or Invisible Man? Authors of color who are writing their own stories and saying, hey, here's how it felt to be a black man in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, or a black woman in the 19-teens and 20s. Take that book of Their Eyes Are Watching God, put it right next to The Great Gatsby, both written right about the same time, super highly symbolic. One from a black female, one from a white male, both talking about issues of privilege and class and wealth and coming-of-age stories. And we can start to see this universality, that it's not just black folks have to write about slavery and racism, white folks have to talk about helping the poor black man. Rather, it's a conversation that we're all party to and we're all part of, because this Black Lives Matter movement, this conversation, like I said, is not just a black issue or a white issue, a Republican or a Democrat issue. It's designed to be a thing that is bringing more voices to the table and say, if the fault is systemic, then the system itself needs to change. And that's not by replacing all of type X with all of type Y. Rather, it's saying, look, we can do more with this. And maybe we do less and do more at the same time. Maybe you don't read the whole novel. Maybe read excerpts of Just Mercy alongside excerpts of To Kill a Mockingbird. There are two or three really powerful sequences in the movie adaptation of Just Mercy, where the main character, who is an African-American lawyer who's fighting to get a black man off of death row in Alabama, is told, have you checked out the To Kill a Mockingbird Museum? It's the biggest testament to the Southern civil rights movement. And it's like mocking and fake. It's like going to see the Rocky statue and saying that's a real social justice warrior. Rocky's fake, right? But this real life character is fighting for real life issues, and his heart is breaking because he's facing all these barriers, these hurdles of systemic racism. And it's like, okay, now take those two books or those two movies and pair them up side by each. How much more enriched and how much more focused and how much more aware do our students become, where it's not enough to say racism was a thing that was old, Martin Luther King gave one or two speeches, we're good now, let's get on with the rest of our lives. But to talk about contemporary issues, real issues, living authors, people who are still protesting and saying, look, it's not because I'm white or because I'm black, because I'm rich, because I'm poor, because I'm gay, because I'm straight, because I'm left or right of center. These are human rights issues, and they're issues that need more conversation. And to talk about each of these things so our students become more mature, more empathetic, and more aware to say, hey, that's just part of the story. There's more to it. And those more to it now bring in those own voices, and that's really, really strong and really enriching because it has a place for more people at that table, again, operating from surplus rather than scarcity. I think that'll do it for me today while the birds are chirping over my head and the cars are moving past in my walk. Be well, be safe. Like I said, I don't mean to offend, but I do mean to provoke. That's part of a job as an instructional coach. If I said anything that has been over the line for any one side or the other, I certainly would love to have further conversation with more nuance and detail. Shoot me a tweet. I'm on Twitter at MeehanEDU. Or on my website, you can find my email address. It's www.adrenalinerush.com. Be well, be safe. I'll catch you next Monday. God bless. Thanks again.